legislative systems that we have. So we started our bill drafting system immediately after session, and I'd like to have Dawn Miner, who is our Technology Transition Program Director, kind of give you a status update on how the project is going, what we've accomplished to date, and how the project will continue for a while. So, Dawn?
Okay. Chair Courtney, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dawn Miner, Applications Development Supervisor for the legislature. And what I'd like to do maybe first is just point out somewhere in your packet is an executive summary of the bill drafting system project. And in this, rather than going over this, what I'd like to do is just kind of add a little bit of information. Yeah. Okay. What I'd like to do is just add some information to this. This is primarily...
Senator Brown?
I'm not sure people got these packets mailed to them, but our office administrator's out, so I don't know if it's useful for folks to have it. For visual learners, I don't know if it's useful to have it in front of us. So we've got one between the three of us.
I have one.
Yeah.
She said we have one between the three of us.
Yes, we're bringing us forward now. Right. If you have need of a packet, please raise your hand. As committee members, Senator Byrne wishes to have a packet. Representative Dennis Richardson on the phone. Do you have a packet?
I do.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else on the phone? Okay, please proceed. Thank you for that, allowing us that interruption, please.
In this summary, it really kind of goes into the business case for the bill drafting system project and goes into a lot more...
Stop, please. Right. We got more problems. What's up, Senator Federico Perio, please?
He has one.
You have one?
Senator Beyer and Patricia.
Then why aren't we stopping if they have one?
Ms. Nielsen is bringing Senator Beyer one as we speak.
That's right, and that's why I went on, because I understood their needs were being taken care of. Is that right?
Is that... You can continue your
adversaries,
Mr. Chairman. We could move forward.
Please, I'm sorry about this. Let me take it. It's my fault. Please forgive me for that. What happened just there. Please proceed.
Thank you. This summary covers pretty much the business case and a lot more detail about the scope of the project. I won't go into that. Most of the information is there, and we'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. What I would like to do, though, is talk a little bit about the background of our planning activities, go into a little detail about what we've accomplished so far in this interim, and talk a little bit about some of the upcoming activities and events that are happening in the near future. As Rich mentioned, the Bill Drafting System project is the last project in our technology transition program, and at the conclusion of that, the program will conclude. One of the things that we noticed early in our planning, we saw that a lot of other states were also looking at replacing their bill drafting systems. But at that time, no one had really jumped in the water yet. And also, some of the technologies that we saw as being kind of key to this project were not quite ready for prime time yet. They were still pretty immature technologies. So we chose to learn from other people's mistakes rather than making our own. And over time, we've been watching the other states as they've gone through their bill drafting system projects, had an opportunity to learn from them. We originally planned this for the 2003 and 2004 interim, but because of budget problems, the project was put off for 2 years. And as Dave mentioned, that was probably a very good thing early before the thing started. We initially started our planning by taking a look at, in the technology transition program, we had kind of a 10,000-foot view of all the projects and all of the applications that we'd be building. We put that off to the last, but we started some high-level planning for that. In July of 2004, we had an opportunity to survey all of the states that were currently involved in bill drafting systems. We did this primarily to refine our project schedule, our staffing needs, and our high-level budget. We looked at their budgets. We looked at their project organization and structure and staffing. We looked at their technical architectures, and even probably more important, we asked them to give us kind of a list of what were your lessons learned in the project? What did you learn throughout this that we could take advantage of? At this point, in 2004, most states were using a model of pretty much selecting software and hardware components and then either building their systems on that entirely, you know, in-house or with a mix of contractors and custom out and then contracting out some of the custom development. So that's kind of our planning activity. Currently, right now, we The project was approved in the 2005 session. Shortly after that, in August of this past year, we took a small team of council and IS staff to the NCSL conference in Seattle, and we had an opportunity to meet with potential vendors. We also interviewed a number of people from other states that were currently involved in build drafting systems projects to get an update on where they were at and what was happening. What we saw at that point was kind of the model was shifting a little bit from purchasing software and hardware components and then custom building applications on top of that to seeing that there were now some vendors that were coming out with custom or coming out with commercial versions of build drafting systems that could be customized for various needs. So we saw the market shift a little bit in that respect that rather than people doing all their own development, there was actually some commercial products out there that looked like, you know, pretty good candidates. One of the strategies we've had throughout the technology transition program is wherever possible, we would look for commercial products to purchase and then integrate into our systems rather than trying to build everything ourselves from scratch. We actually formally started the project in September of this year. We contracted with a firm for project management services that had been involved in a number of build drafting systems projects in other states following an RFP process. And we also did something kind of interesting at that time. Looking at ways to try to save money, we did a concurrent recruitment. So we were looking at recruiting for a temporary or limited duration position project manager at the same time. One of our finalists looked pretty good, but not quite as good as the firm that we contracted with. Following the start of the project, we also we had our project charter and plan approved by the Technology Transition Program IT Governance Board in November. Shortly after that, we selected a quality assurance contractor for project management processes, but for product. We began then an extensive process to define all of council's their business processes, evaluating the current system in terms of functionality, user requirements, technical requirements, interfaces with our existing legislative systems, and we also did a fairly high-level kind of an architecture of how a new system might look and work. At that point, we started a process to select the vendor. We did two things. We did something that's a little unusual for us. We did a request for qualifications first to kind of narrow down the field. We knew that if we kind of just opened this up, we might have a lot of vendors wanting to come in and do development for us. So we narrowed down the field pretty much to three vendors. And at that point, we started a formal RFP process to select a final vendor. So far, we've gone through, we've received all of the proposals. We've had each of the vendors come in and do an all-day demonstration and answer questions of our project team. And at this point, we're in the process of scoring the proposals and evaluating the proposals. And we should be done tomorrow. We should finalize that tomorrow. Some of the upcoming activities that we have is that, again, we're going to be finalizing our selection of a vendor this week. And we'll begin working with leadership, JLC, IMT, and the e-board on our final plans to complete the project. As soon as we have a vendor selected and a contract signed, we intend to start kind of a short-term process for the vendor to come in and finalize all of the requirements with council staff and also start design. That should happen prior to this summer. And at this point, we're still on schedule to implement the build drafting system in early 2008, and that'll be for the 2009 build drafting cycle. Any questions?
Any questions? Comments? Thank you. Is that complete the report on the build drafting project?
Yes, that does.
And I'd like to move back to the head of the agenda on the organizational meeting. And I request that a motion to adopt the rules, please.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the proposed committee rules dated 3/21/06.
Senator Brown has moved that we adopt the proposed committee rules, which are set out in a document 3/21/06. Discussion about the rules? Any objections? The rules are adopted. We now go to work session. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Oregon State Capital Foundation was created in statute in the 1997 session, and it consists of a board of up to 25 members serving four-year terms. We have four members whose terms have either expired in the last year or will expire in June of this year. And we have one member who has left the foundation, and we have a replacement that has been recommended by the foundation. The four whose terms have either expired or will expire in June are Catherine Bo Duncan, Frank Bronner, Lewis Hampton, and Anthony Meeker. Pat Egan was on the foundation but chose to leave when he accepted the position that he went to in Portland. And at that point, the foundation members made a recommendation. They have a nominations committee, and they've recommended Bill Markham to replace Pat Egan on the foundation. That would get us back to the number that we need on the foundation, and we would need no more action on foundation appointments until sometime in 2007.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, so Senator Brown, do you know what we're doing here?
Yep.
Okay.
I move the appointment and reappointments to the Capital Foundation Committee of Catherine Bo Duncan, Frank Bronner, Lewis Hampton, Bill Markham, and Anthony Meeker.
All right. Senator Brown has moved that the appointments, reappointments of Catherine Bo Duncan, Frank Bronner, Lewis Hampton, Bill Markham, and Anthony Meeker be approved by the Oregon State Capital Foundation. Discussion? Any objections? Thank you. Let us now continue on our informational meeting and now go to the report on the Oregon Channel discussions with the Oregon Public Broadcasting, Southern Oregon Public Television, and OPAM, right?
That's correct.
All right.
And I will ask Bill Gross, who is our media supervisor, to join me, and he's going to give you a more in-depth report on this project. As a way of introduction, we conducted a project last year during the session, and it was the project sponsors were the chiefs of staff of the president and the speaker. So Gary Wilhelms and Connie Seeley headed up that project to look at the most efficient way to distribute the legislative information as broadly as possible in the state. Coming out of that project, it was determined that a partnership involving Oregon Public Broadcasting, Southern Oregon Public Television, and OPAN would be the best approach to accomplish that goal. And we have been working with those organizations since then to implement that. And we are at a point where we believe we will have a pilot project ready to run during the 2007 session, ensuring that content of all the legislative hearings and floor sessions will be carried throughout the state. And I'll let Bill fill you in on some of the details.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thought I'd start with a little bit of background on some history of distribution that our department has done over the years. Distribution has taken many forms, but has relied ultimately on programming time made available to us on cable public access channels, such as up in Portland, MCTV, here in Salem, CCTV, and Rogue Valley, RVTV. We've sent tapes via Greyhound bus before. We've used the old EdNet satellite system, which doesn't exist anymore. We've even sent tapes in the mail every day down to Southern Oregon. Currently, we're using a combination of microwave and internet technologies, but ultimately, again, we rely on those cable public access channels, and our reach is really limited by geography. We're primarily reaching only the Willamette and Rogue Valleys. We're not reaching anywhere in the eastern portions of the states, and certainly none of the rural areas that are not served by cable. So during last session, we initiated an analysis project to look at ways of distributing our television content throughout the state and making it as available as possible. And we worked with, again, the staff directors from leadership and caucus offices to develop some requirements for this project. The biggest were if distribution should be able to provide gavel-to-gavel, unedited coverage of the legislature, and technology should not be too restrictive, especially for the rural areas. The results were interesting in that individual methods of distribution are fairly restrictive for access. With cable television, only about a about a third of the state doesn't have cable, and not all cable systems are willing to provide a channel that's dedicated towards legislative coverage. Satellite television, satellite subscribers, only about 20% of Oregon households subscribe to satellite. Getting a channel on those satellite systems is prohibitively expensive, probably millions of dollars per year to get a channel on those systems. And the internet, we found you really need high-speed internet access to watch video coverage of the legislature, certainly if you want to recognize any faces. Roughly about 70% of households have access to the internet, but only about a third of households have high-speed internet access, and mostly that is in residential areas, and it's fairly limited out in rural areas. So we then looked at potential partnerships out there, especially with television organizations that can fill in the gaps, if you will, of some of these individual technologies. And some recent developments made in the arena of public television organizations made a OPB and SOP TV partnership appear very promising. Number one, television stations are transitioning from analog to digital, and that's going to allow them to broadcast not just one channel of content, but multiple channels of content, up to four, I believe. And this transition will be completed by 2009, although currently most television stations are right now broadcasting in both the analog and digital realm. In 2009, they'll turn off their analog transmitters. This opens a possibility of partnerships for carrying legislative television coverage on one of those digital channels. And number two, the other biggest development last session, nationally, PBS and the cable industry signed a carriage agreement where cable operators agreed to carry all of the digital channels offered by local PBS stations. So, number two, we can build on a partnership already in place between PBS and the cable industry. So we came to the conclusion that based on that, a partnership with OPB and SOP TV offers the best prospects for truly statewide access to legislative coverage. Viewers could access the channel over the airwaves or on cable television. The internet can be added as a third method of access. And long term, a channel created with a solution could be accessible for most households around the state, not just one half, not just two thirds, but a majority of households around Oregon. So that brings us to the pilot project, the Oregon Channel. What is it? The current thinking is the concept would be modeled after C-SPAN and some other networks, state networks, such as TVW to the north of us. It would be gavel-to-gavel, unedited coverage of state government and other public affairs of statewide interest. The pilot involves a four-way partnership between OPB and Southern Oregon Public Television, legislative media, where we would provide coverage of events here in the Capitol, and the Oregon Public Affairs Network, which would provide most of the non-government public affairs content, such as lectures, debates, and speeches. The pilot would launch during opening day of session, 2007 session, and would conclude at the end of session. Content on the Oregon Channel, short term, the pilot would consist primarily of legislative coverage from our department during session and some non-government events provided by the Oregon Public Affairs Network. Long term, if we were to decide to make the Oregon Channel permanent, we'd envision a broad mix of content from all branches of government and non-government events. From the government side, you'd have, in addition to the legislature, state agency hearings and Supreme Court hearings. From the non-government side, possibilities include city club speeches, university lectures, and debates. Oregon Public Broadcasting and Southern Oregon Public Television would distribute the Oregon Channel pilot on a 24/7 digital television channel. Again, it would be available over the airwaves within their existing broadcast areas, available on cable systems per the PBS cable industry agreement. And however, there would be some limitations. Number one, digital television adoption is still a few years away. Right now, most households don't own a digital television set in their homes. You would need a set-top box to receive over-the-air signals currently. It'll probably be 2009 before most households have that technology. Also, Oregon Public Broadcasting and Southern Oregon still don't have all of their statewide translators upgraded from analog to digital. That is still several years out. So likely for the pilot, cable will be still be the primary means of access for the pilot project. The objectives of our pilot, we want to provide a proof of concept for implementing a statewide Oregon channel. We want to know this model works in other states, but will it work for Oregon? We want to get feedback from viewers to see what changes are needed to make the Oregon channel better. And we want to know what's the best way to manage this channel among four different partners. We also want to explore other potential uses for an Oregon channel, including any potential homeland security applications. And finally, we want to research detailed cost estimates for making this channel truly available statewide. And ultimately, include all of this in a business plan at the end of the pilot. And Dave, I believe you were going to address some of the pilot costs.
Right. There's, I know there are going to be questions about what is this going to cost to launch this. Our best estimates at this point are that the pilot itself will cost about $150,000. OPB and SOPTV have absorbed some of the costs of equipment that they need internally, but we are still looking at about $150,000. We are scouring the legislative administration budget for savings in any areas that we can. We're watching the legislative assembly budget, and at this point, we're hopeful that we can identify enough savings to cover that cost. We have presented this information to the facilities committee of the public commission, and I believe at their last meeting they passed a motion that said should it be necessary to come to the emergency board in September for any final little bit of money that might be needed, they would be supportive of that. It has not gone to the full commission yet, so it will take the action of the full commission before that might be necessary. We're hopeful.
I'm sorry, Dave, could you just repeat that again?
Sure. The facilities committee of the public commission did pass a motion that said that encouraging the full commission to support the concept of the Oregon Channel and, if necessary, to go to the emergency board in September for an appropriation if it's needed at that time to finalize the arrangements. About half of that cost is for the actual fiber connection between Portland and Medford to get the signal from Portland down to Southern Oregon. At this point, I would say the odds are good that we'll find the money and we won't have to make any requests for additional funding.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say thank you to the presiding officers for taking the lead on this. I think this is long overdue. Oregon is way behind a number of our other states, and I think they've put together a really good package in front of us, and we are all hoping that they will not have to come forward to the e-board for any money, but it's time for us to do this to make sure that all citizens have access to the legislative process. So thank you. Appreciate your work. Appreciate the presiding officers' leadership on this issue.
Further discussion? Oh, Representative Jeff Murphy, please.
Thank you. Do you have anything to say that half of the cost is getting the signal to Medford?
Chair Courtney, Representative Merkley, that's, about $65,000 to $75,000 of the cost is for that, yes.
And just for us non-techies, what is the reason that can't just be sent through high-speed internet?
I'm going to defer for another non-techie. I'm going to defer to Bill on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the internet, we've been using it to send signal down to the public access channel down in Southern Oregon. We found that using the public internet is subject to frequent disruptions. It's sort of subject to a lot of heavy internet traffic. If there's a lot of heavy traffic, it can disrupt the signal that goes down there. If not for seconds, it might be minutes at a time. And in the broadcast world, broadcasters they need to maintain a consistent signal, number one, to maintain their FCC license requirements for broadcasting. And using the public internet as a means to distribute doesn't necessarily meet their quality requirements for broadcast.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Perry, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been probably a three-year struggle, and I'm not even sure that we've seen a success, but Ontario is in the Boise market. So they get their news from Boise. And it was only very recently that the city council was able to compel or arrange for, at the threat of cancellation of a cable franchise, carrying Portland news on in just one broadcast a day in Ontario. Am I to assume that this statewide public net includes or excludes Ontario?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, our intention for a fully implemented channel would be to include all communities around the state. However, for the pilot, I'm not sure if Ontario falls in within the existing broadcast reach of, I believe it'd be Oregon Public Broadcasting's transmitter. I can research that and get back to you, but right now I think La Grande may be the furthest east that they currently reach, but I can research that for you.
Yeah, I think it's Baker City and La Grande do, and Ontario doesn't.
Enterprise probably doesn't either.
But we can talk about that. I'd be interested to know if the pilot won't include that reach. Because there is an affiliate that broadcasts from Boise that is that has a close connection with a Portland network. It's possible that you could use the same mechanism to bring OPB feed into the Ontario area, but I think we'll have to start quickly to get that conversation going, because it took a couple of years to get just basic broadcast news there. But we can have that conversation offline.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since this is a pilot, I am tempted to ask if we could be canceled if no one is watching us. But that wasn't really my question. I'm curious, are there any possibilities for this to turn into an interactive system where people would ultimately be able to actually show up somewhere and testify by video to committees?
Chair Courtney, Representative Rosenbaum, we have that capacity right now in hearing rooms A through F, and we use it on occasion, interactive video conferencing. And our feeling is that this will encourage more people to be aware of what's going on, and yes, it would ultimately lead to greater involvement in that way.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair, can you tell me how this is in real time, some of it, and then some of it would be tape delayed, and how are decisions going to be made about what gets broadcast when? I'm always curious when the House and the Senate are meeting at the same time, which of us gets to be on. I think that alternates, but
we have had in existence for some time a broadcast advisory group that is made up of representatives from legislative media, the four caucus offices, the presiding officers, the desks, and committees. And what they do is they meet Mondays of every session week and go over the schedule for that week, consider what issues are going to be discussed in what committees, and they make decisions that, well, we know there's going to be a lot of interest in this hearing in the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee on Thursday. So we'll schedule that. At the same time, we will be taping other committees that are going on, and they would be shown on a tape delay basis. But that group has made recommendations, and that is an issue that has been discussed with the other partners in the Oregon Channel Project. And the feeling right now is that the decision-making would take place in legislative media as to the scheduling of all these items. And we adjust that schedule frequently throughout the session or throughout the week as new issues are added to committee agendas or things get scheduled for floor action. We look for what's going to have the broadest appeal and try to show those live and then tape delay the other meetings.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further discussion? Thank you. Report on electrical project.
Mr. Chair, I will ask Herb Colon to join us, and he can fill you in on details. This project was approved in the 2005-07 budget. It's about $1,032,000, half of which was a general fund appropriation, and half of which is being funded out of our operating the capital operating account, which is money that is generated from rents from tenants in the building. So we're paying for half of it with those funds and then half of it with general funds. And Herb can tell you exactly where we are on the project.
Chair Courtney, Herb, for the record, Herb Colon, Facility Services Manager, Legislative Administration. We actually got underway with the project early part of January. First thing we had to do was get some offices out of the way in the room 43 where the new equipment is going to be housed. We moved the Oregonian and Register Guard across the hall. They are now in their new offices. We have temporarily located the television studios in the lobby message center with some temporary wiring. They are really in some cramped spaces for right now. But we pull all the cables that they would need to maintain their functionality and they're surviving here for now. The walls in the new area have been erected and painted. The new press briefing room is being laid out right now. The black walls are up there. This is for television coverage purposes to help with the contrast in there. We have so far removed one abandoned cable that was running from the fifth floor down to the basement. This is one of the old cloth-covered copper cables, and it came out successfully, so we're hoping that the remaining cables that we have to pull will come out as easily, and the new ones will go back in. As we are speaking, the new equipment cabinets are arriving right now down in the garage and are being wheeled through room 49, through CAFE today and into room 43. These are about 1,200-pound cabinets, so I'm hoping everyone is staying out of the way as they come through. We are on track right now to shut off the power in the old portion of the Capitol from the 22nd of April through the 30th of April. These sets of hearing rooms, A through F, will be turned into temporary offices. A through C will house the Secretary of State. D through F will house the governor's staff, as well as hearing room 174.
Mr. Cohen, my understanding is the Marion County courts have been meeting in hearing rooms A through F. Where will they go?
They have been told that there will be no room available for them for the 2 weeks before the project until the week after the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad I'm not practicing in Marion County right now.
They will move back in as soon as the project is finished. And the latest word I have on them as an aside is that they will probably be in here until the 1st of September.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Roger Byer, please.
Thank you. While we're on the Marion County Courts, I was curious, you mentioned that the tenants pay us rent. I know the governor, secretary of state, treasurer do. Do the Marion County Courts pay us rent, too, for use of these buildings, of the rooms?
Chair Courtney, Senator Byer, we made a decision when they moved in that, in effect, those are funded by the judicial branch, and you'd be transferring state money from one state agency to another state agency. And our hearing rooms are not used extensively in the interim, and we made a decision then that we would allow them to stay at no charge.
As opposed to the governor's office and the secretary of state and the treasurer, who are funded by...
That's a very good point, and as permanent residents of the building, we think it's appropriate that they should contribute. But considering the challenge that was facing the Marion County courts, we did make that decision to allow them at no charge.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, the rest of the courts in this state have to fund their own court buildings, and I understand what happened downtown. I'm sure I'm guessing they probably have insurance coverage that's covering the building downtown. And so just talking about equities here.
Thank you, Senator Roger Bauer from Malala. Could you please proceed?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Our project is what did I say? I'm sorry, Mr. President.
You worry about New Hampshire.
Project is on schedule to be completed, and we expect everyone to be in their new offices by the end of May. And if anyone is interested, either immediately after the meeting today or at times of your convenience, I'd be glad to show you what's going on down in that area.
Okay.
Any questions?
Is that it?
Yes, sir.
You do have in your packet a sheet that outlines where all of the offices that are being dislocated will be during the time that the building will be shut down, in case you have any questions.
Does everybody here know what's going on? Got old deals. They built the building in 1937, right? And
correct,
they got this
sir.
Big cable from the road out there coming into the building, right?
Actually, it's a copper bar.
All right. How big is the copper bar? Okay. And the deal is, we got to change it because why?
Once it gets to the building, it goes into a distribution system that is large breakers that control the power distribution throughout the building, designed to cut off if something catastrophic were to happen in the building. We had a couple of contractors come in. We wanted to test the system to make sure it still functioned properly. We were told that they would not turn off the breakers because they couldn't guarantee they could turn them back on. The breakers were that old. The system was manufactured in place. There are no replacement parts for it. So before it failed catastrophically on us, which would have meant we'd been out of power for probably 6 months, we are replacing it now on a controlled situation.
All right, thank you. Any further discussions on this little topic? Just let you know quickly what's going on. Yes?
I'm assuming that folks coordinate enough that we're not having any committee hearings scheduled while the building's essentially shut down.
President Gordon, Senator Brown, that is correct. And committees is also taking advantage of trying to do some road trips during that time.
And different offices are affected, as opposed to in the wings versus the old section, just so everybody knows. Because this is going to be in the living for just a 24-hour period. So
that's for a whole week, right?
That's correct.
My office will be shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. I guess now we go to, I know we go to report on security, correct?
Yes, that's correct. This is one item for which you don't have a handout, and that is intentional on our part. I would be happy to share with any of you following this meeting or at any time. If you want to come to my office, I can share with you some of the information that has been developed by various sources that I'll touch on briefly. But that information is exempt from disclosure under the public records law for very good reason, that it relates to the security of the building. So we would prefer to not have that as part of the official record of the committee meeting. But as I said, any of you are welcome to come and review any of that information. Following the events of 9/11, we have gone through some extensive reviews of security here in the Capitol. We've taken a number of steps to improve the security based on input that we've received from three separate studies that were done. We asked the U.S. Secret Service to come in and conduct an audit of our security. We had the Marion County Sheriff's Office come in and do the same thing, and the Oregon State Police as well. Each of them developed a report which we have reviewed and adopted a number of the proposals that were included in there. Among the things that we've done to improve security are that we have now limited public access to three doors into the building. At one time, I think we had seven doors that people were allowed to come and go through, and we've now limited that down to just three doors. The other doors, staff and legislators are still able to access by use of a card key system, which improves the security because now we only have to monitor the public coming in through three doors. We have installed additional security cameras throughout the building, and we have access monitors reviewing those cameras the entire time that the building is open. We don't monitor them at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning because there's nobody coming and going at those times, but they are monitored at all times. They also monitor the vehicles coming and going from the underground parking. Prior to 9/11, we didn't close the gates on that. We have since installed the roll-up gates, which are activated now by the card keys. And our access monitors do know that when that door goes up, we recognize that there is some vulnerability there because of the time that it has to stay up to allow cars to get in or trucks to get in. And we do We do monitor that so that when the gate goes up, the access monitor is to be watching that camera just in case somebody tries to sneak in at that time. In addition to that, we had the opportunity following the Salt Lake Olympic Games to purchase two metal detectors that we were able to get for a fraction of their original cost. We have those. They're in storage. We have tested them. They are perfectly able to operate, and should the need arise, we can deploy those and have them here and up and running in a matter of hours. We developed a matrix that involves increasing levels of security based on what any potential threat may be to the building, ranging from the status that we're in right now all the way to where potentially, should it be necessary, both Court Street and State Street could be closed to vehicle traffic. That plan was put together, and we're basically operating under that matrix right now. We have had tremendous support from the Sheriff's Office, the State Police, and the Secret Service. We have implemented a large number of their suggestions. The one item that has been consistent in all of those is that the underground parking is still perhaps our greatest area of vulnerability. And we have worked with the company that has installed the card reader system to develop a proposal that would allow us to secure the doors that come from the building into the underground parking and from the underground parking into the building. The estimated cost on that system is about $50,000. And what we would look for from the committee is any direction you would like to give us as to whether that is something we should look at pursuing to try to implement prior to the 07 session, or is it something that we should be putting together as an option package for consideration with our 07-09 budget, at which point we could actually do that project following the 07 session. That is a thumbnail sketch of our security situation right now.
So you're suggesting that the card system would work on the doors that come into the building, same system?
Yes, it would be the same system. And we would limit access so that right now, if you're in the Senate wing, you can go down to the underground parking. You know, a member of the public can walk into the building, get on the elevator, and access that. That would be stopped. You'd have to have the card key to access the underground parking. No members of the public would. All of the doors would be secured in a way that only those who are authorized would be able to get down there.
Senator Brown, please. Others? Any security questions? Is that the report?
That's the report.
This is being worked through the Public Commission, as you said, right? They're looking at this whole, and you're folding all this in with them and all this, these reports and things, I hope.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The Facilities Committee is looking at this and will be recommending back to the full commission.
Okay, great. When's that going to happen, you know, if you don't?
They have a meeting. The Facilities Committee is scheduled to meet in April. I believe April 12th is what seems to.
Thank you. Next topic is the budget overview.
And for this, I would ask Sandra Ryerson to join me. You know Sandra, our financial services manager, and the last person left in the room. You have in your packet this document, which is a summary of two portions of the legislative branch budget. First of all, the legislative assembly budget, which is the budget for the 90 members, the six leadership offices, and the desks. And then you've got a summary of the legislative administration budget on the bottom half of that spreadsheet. I will go through very briefly the numbers on that. The budget request for the Legislative Assembly was $26,712,000. The adjustments that were made in the budget bill were the PERS rate reduction, which all agencies took a reduction on that. The AG's rate reduction was possible because of the reduced rate that were charged by the Department of Justice for their legal work. There was one addition there, which was $133,000 to fund a position for the support of the public commission, as well as some of the travel and meeting expenses of the commission.
there was an additional $200,000 that was added to allow the assembly to contract with a consultant to review some of the IT work that is going on in the executive branch. At this point, no contract has been let. There are discussions ongoing with the co-chairs of the JLCIMT, and we don't know where that will turn up. The assessments and charges were a reduction that were statewide for every agency, leaving you with a total of $26,907,000 in the assembly budget for 05-07. Within legislative administration, again, the $21.1 million was the requested amount. The PERS rate reduction, EAG's rate reduction are in there. We, on the personal services reduction, we eliminated one accountant position in the financial services office that had been vacant, and we reduced four positions in committee services from continuing positions to session-only positions. Three were committee administrator positions, which we had not filled in the last biennium, and we felt that we could, that still left eight positions, and we felt that we could get by with that number of continuing committee administrators. The other position was the library general's position, which was reduced from a continuing position to a session-only position. The reduction in services and supplies, there were two large sources that were reduced within our information systems office. We took a $100,000 reduction in staff training, and within the committee services budget, we took a $100,000 reduction in services and supplies in that office. There were some other smaller reductions that got us up to that figure of $316,000, but those were the two largest reductions. Another one was about $25,000 in the committee's travel budget, which was used to bring in expert witnesses and to pay for committee travel. The special payments was an adjustment that was made within our contract with the Oregon State Police to provide security in the building. There was a sergeant position that had not been budgeted appropriately, so we had to add $23,000 for that. The technology transition package was a package that went with the bill drafting project in Legislative Council, which would allow us to replace some aging hardware and software. And in fact, just this last weekend, we replaced some of the equipment in the hub closets that serve a large portion of the building, and we will continue to do that throughout the biennium to upgrade that equipment. The bill drafting system, as you see, is a $1.9 million other fund item, and that is another fund item because it was approved through the issuance of COPs. Then right below that, you've got the debt service and the financing cost for the COPs, which are a general fund item. Again, as we discussed earlier, the electrical gearbox replacement is a little over $1 million project, half of which was a general fund appropriation and half of which is coming out of our capital operating account. We had the assessment, the DAS assessment reduction, as all agencies had, leaving us with a total budget for legislative administration of $21.5 million general fund and about $26.5 million for all funds. That is a quick synopsis of the legislatively adopted budget for 05-07. We have started the process of preparing our budget request for 07-09. We've gone to the kickoff meeting for preparation of the budget. Sandra is working with our analyst from budget and management to work on that. They'll have a detailed meeting at the end of April on the process for preparing the budget. At this point, we are working up any potential policy option packages for items that we feel need to come before this committee. We're also preparing our essential service level budget at this point. What was done 2 years ago, you may recall, is that you appointed a work group of members of the committee to meet with us prior or as we were developing our budget. And that is something that I think Senator Ferrioli served on that work group. Senator Burdick was appointed but was not able to participate. Representative Haas and Representative Doyle participated on the House side. It would be up to the co-chairs of the committee if you wish to appoint a work group to
work with us as we go through the process this time. Another option would be for us to develop our requested budget and report back to the next meeting of this committee. And that is a thumbnail sketch of both the assembly budget and the legislative administration budget. The budgets for fiscal, council, and revenue are prepared in those offices. So any questions about those, I would have to ask you to talk with the folks in charge there.
Thank you. Discussion of the budget overview. Representative Rosenbaum, please. Excuse me. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about the public commission on the legislature. Are there recommendations that are possibly coming from it that will impact the budget for the legislature for the next biennium?
Chair Courtney, Representative Rosenbaum, there are a number of proposals that are moving forward. I don't believe that the full commission has taken final action on anything right now, but we're monitoring that, and we're trying to determine what the costs of any of those proposals would be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? You're out there, aren't you, Representative Dennis Richardson? Still, aren't you, please?
I am. I'm listening to every word.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there other items that members of the Legislative Administration Committee like to place at this time on our agenda? Representative Richardson, do you have any items?
No, I don't. I really do appreciate the in-depth report we received on the technology project for Legislative Council. I think that's an excellent way to discuss the.
Thank you, and thank you for being on the state by phone today. Without further ado, this meeting is adjourned.